Let's get back into Exodus chapter 22, where I had to kind of stop yesterday because of time in the middle of what I think is a pretty important principle that we need to talk about. We're dealing in the conversation back and forth between God and Moses about how to carry out this covenant of consideration of other people. The Jewish people have great need for a legal system to help them do the right thing. A law system is intended for those that have a tendency not to want to do the right thing. It's to force appropriate behavior. So these guys are being given very specific scenarios as to how things should happen in dealing with people. Because the ultimate goal, as the New Testament teaches, is that we should love God with 100% of our being and then love all of the people made in God's image with the same sort of love that we have for ourselves and that God has for us. And so in Exodus 22, verse 2, it says that if a thief is found breaking in and is struck so that he dies, there shall be no blood guilt for him. So the scenario is, you're in your house, the lights are all out, you hear a noise, there's someone clearly breaking in, you're afraid for your life, you're afraid for the life of your family, and you strike out against this person, and you end up killing them. Well, you didn't do that on purpose. You really didn't want this to be the case. The person was somewhere where they didn't belong at the time that they didn't belong there, and that's what resulted in their death. But in verse 3, it says this, if the sun has risen on him, there shall be blood guilt for him. He shall surely pay. If he has nothing, then he shall be sold for his theft. Two things involved here. First of all, if the theft was happening in daylight, then what should occur is the minimal amount of force needed to stop the theft. So you're going to try to use a non-lethal response, not a lethal response. Even if the guy runs off with it, then you don't shoot him in the back with a bow and arrow, because this is not a capital crime that he's committing. He is stealing some of your private property, yes, but execution is not the penalty for stealing private property. It's repayment. So if you kill someone for theft, you have crossed the line because you have not shown the due respect for the image of God in that person. And I know that comes hard for a lot of people, because they want to overreact sometimes when people are doing things to them. But we as Christians, we as the followers of God, need to rein in our knee-jerk reactions and do what is appropriate. Now, the second part of the verse does go on. Yeah, the guy is now going to have to pay appropriately for what he's done. He needs to pay back. He gives back the animal. Then he's supposed to pay back double. That's what comes up in verse 4. If the stolen beast is found alive in his possession, whether it is an ox or a donkey or sheep, he shall pay double. So if you catch the guy in the act, he owes you twice the amount that he was trying to steal. So he gives you back the animal he was taking, and he owes you another animal. That's the rule. If he doesn't have another animal, then he's going to go into this indebtedness slavery. Now, it shouldn't take him an awful long time to pay it off, because an animal is not worth, you know, years of slavery. It would be worth probably a few days of servitude. But he will have to pay. That's the rule. So we've talked about this before, that what's being laid out here is trying to make things right, not just simply throwing people in jail for doing a crime. You make them do the right thing. Pay it back plus more. As a reminder to them, don't do this sort of thing. It's wrong. Verse number 5. Moving to another topic. Wait a second. Before we go there. In the New Testament, it is interesting that Zacchaeus, the tax collector, when he is talking to Jesus over lunch, says in part of his repentance that, Lord, as a new man, as a new person, I'm going to give away half of what I have to the poor. And if I've defrauded anyone, I will pay them back four times over. And so he is basically going back to this passage here and saying, I will go to the extreme of repayment to anyone that I have defrauded. Now, that doesn't mean he had defrauded anyone, just means that he was willing to make it up to people that might come to him and show him that he had treated them unfairly. So I just think it's interesting that these Old Testament principles were being applied by New Testament characters. All right, verse number 5. If a man causes a field or vineyard to be grazed over, so he lets his animals go in there and they eat up a lot more than they should, or he lets his beast loose and it feeds in another man's field, he shall make restitution from the best of his own field and in his own vineyard. So the grain and the fruits of the vine and all of that belong to another person. That's their private property. You can't let your animal just eat that stuff and not pay for it. That's not fair. Private property is a real thing in our world of men. It's actually the principle of do unto others as you would have them do to you. If you've got something that belongs to you and somebody takes it and can't give it back to you, they should at least pay you for it. And so that's what's being described here. Then verse number 6. If fire breaks out and catches in thorns. Thorns were often the dry, weedy parts between fields, like hedgerows. So that the stacked grain or the standing grain or the field is consumed, he who started the fire shall make full restitution. So if you're burning off, say, your harvested field to try to get it ready for plowing and planting later in the year, and you don't pay enough attention, and your fire gets into the hedgerow, and then it spreads from the hedgerow over into your neighbor's place and actually gets into their stacked grain, and it destroys it, guess what? You owe them. Because it was your choice to start the fire and not tend to it that led to that grain being destroyed. Even if it was accidental. You know, the wind picked up suddenly and went across the barrier. Doesn't matter. You owe your neighbor for the loss of their property because of your choice. And everybody really still needs to be living by that sort of standard. Any of us, through our action, if we cause other people harm or loss, we really ought to voluntarily make that up. That would be the heartfelt biblical standard. Verse number 7. If a man gives to his neighbor money or goods to keep safe, and it's stolen from the man's house, then if the thief is found, he shall pay double. So you go on holiday, and back at this time, you might ask your neighbor to kind of keep some stuff for you of value. Well, your neighbor's house gets broken into while you're gone. That's going to, first of all, be the responsibility of the thief. And hopefully they'll get busted in the act and they'll have to pay back double. If they don't, then they'll end up paying back even more when they do get caught. But what happens if they don't get caught? Well, verse 8. If the thief is not found, the owner of the house shall come near to God, meaning appear before the tabernacle or later before the temple or before the priests, and show whether or not he's put his hand to his neighbor's property. So effectively, the person has to take an oath before God, I didn't take it. It really was stolen. And it would be assumed then that he would not be responsible for its theft. As long as he took appropriate precautions to keep his house from being broken into, then he's not responsible for the loss of the material that his neighbor asked him to keep safe, because it could have happened to anyone. Now, if he hadn't taken due precautions, or if he had taken it for himself, then the judges, once they figured that out, would assign appropriate penalties. Verse number 9, for every breach of trust, whether it's for an ox, for a donkey, for a sheep, for a cloak, or for any kind of lost thing of which one is said, this is it, the case of both parties shall come before God, the one whom God condemns shall pay double to his neighbor. Effectively, this is where you make an accusation of somebody else. Hey, that's mine. You stole it from me. So you're accusing the person of being a thief from an earlier situation. And so both parties go before God. That means they would be going before the priests or before the Levites. We'll be talking about how they're the ones carrying out these things later. And there are oaths that apparently are supposed to be taken, and it may be that the Urim and the Thummim that we'll talk about later is used to get God's determination on who's at fault. If it turns out that somebody had stolen it, they have to pay back double because they still have the property, because that's how you figured it out, right? Hey, that's my rake. No, it's not. Yes, it is. Let's go to the priest. Let's talk before God, and God can decide whether or not that's my rake. Turns out it's your rake. You get that rake, plus you get another rake. Your neighbor has to pay you a second rake, or monetary equivalent. Verse 10, if a man gives to his neighbor a donkey, or an ox, or a sheep, or any beast to keep safe, and it dies or is injured, or it's driven away without anyone seeing it, an oath by he who is, or in the name of he who is, shall be between both to see whether or not he's put his hand on his neighbor's property. The owner shall accept the oath, and he shall not make restitution. So same sort of thing we've already been talking about, just a little bit more detail. But if it was stolen from him, he shall make restitution to its owner. Meaning, if it's his fault that it got stolen. You know, he left the donkey out in the open field instead of bringing it in to the more secure corral at night. And so it's missing the next day. That wasn't taking due care of the animal that he was supposed to be protecting. So he owes his neighbor for that. Now, verse 13, if it's torn by beasts, let him bring it as evidence, and he shall not make restitution for what's been torn. So a wild animal comes in and attacks the donkey. Well, as long as he'd been taking due precautions and it was just one of those things where the animal came in and killed it, you show the dead animal and that should be sufficient. Because it could have happened even to the owner of the donkey. Just might have been one of those things. Verse 14. If a man borrows anything of his neighbor and it's injured or it dies, the owner not being with it, he shall make full restitution. So we're still talking about animals here. So you borrow your neighbor's donkey and you're using it to do some work in your yard or on your property. And the donkey dies. Doesn't matter how it dies. It dies while you're using it. Then you owe your neighbor a donkey because you were borrowing it from him and used it all up. It doesn't matter if it had a heart attack because it was getting older. You should have taken that in consideration when you borrowed it. That's the principle that we're talking about here. But here's the other deal, verse 15. If the owner was with it, he shall not make restitution. If it was hired, it came for its hiring fee. So if you ask your neighbor, could you come over with your donkey and help me do some stuff? And the owner goes, oh yeah, I'll come over. I'll bring my donkey and we'll do some work. And the donkey dies. Well, that's not your fault because the owner was right there. Or if you were renting a donkey, you know, you went down to the rental place and you rented a donkey for the day. Well, in the rental contract, you would have paid for the possibility that the donkey might be injured or die on the job. And so if that happens, you've already paid for it. And so that's not your fault. You don't have to pay for the loss of the donkey. Verse number 16. Now we move to another topic. And this is another one where I think people have horribly misunderstood it. And I have heard non-Christians rage about this passage. And it frustrates me because they're raging about something that it does not mean. Okay? So verse number 16. If a man seduces a virgin who is not engaged to be married and lies with her, he shall give the bride price for her and make her his wife. This is not about a rape. Rape is a capital offense, folks. We will see that very clearly later. If a man rapes a woman, he is to be executed. Case closed. What we are seeing here is a couple of unmarried young people having premarital sex, and they get found out. Neither one of them is engaged to be married. So if a young single man, unengaged, talks a young, single, unengaged woman into sleeping with him, having sex with him, and they get caught that that's what's been going on, then he needs to just go ahead and pay the dowry and the two of them get married. Because they've apparently already made up their mind that they want to act like they're married. And so they're married. Except for one little problem here. Mom and dad still have some say in this. And dad is the one that's represented here for the two of them. If her father utterly refuses to give her to him. So he's like, there is no way in the world you are going to marry that scoundrel. I told you I didn't want you to be anywhere near him. I don't care that you two slept together and think it's a good idea. I don't. So I will not sign off on you getting married. Well, it still says here that he, meaning the young man, shall pay money equal to the bride price for virgins. So he still has to pay the dowry. Because that's what should have happened in the first place. If he wished to marry the young woman, he should have offered the dowry in order to make the marriage agreement. So he is basically paying a penalty out of his own pocket, or more likely out of the pocket of his parents, for his choice to go around behind the backs of the mothers and fathers that would have known about this couple. So I want everybody to think of this in the context of young teenagers, or maybe older teenagers, that jump the gun on getting married, and what needs to happen is go through with the marriage unless there's other issues, such as the couple really shouldn't be together because there's problems with either the young man or the young woman. Okay? Verse number 18, whole nother topic, because you've got a picture in your mind here that Moses and God are talking on the mountain, and Moses is probably going over a whole bunch of things that are on his list that he wants to know about, because he knows it's going to come up sooner or later with the people, and he needs to know what the standard is. Verse number 18, you shall not permit a sorceress to live. Now, sorceress here is represented in the Greek Old Testament as someone who uses drugs in order to affect the spirit world. And so it's actually the taking of drugs or the inhaling of herbs and things of that nature that change the brain chemistry and put a person into an altered state of consciousness with the intention of contacting the spirit world. The goal of a sorceress, and it does use the feminine here because that was the gender typical at this time in history for this sort of activity to go on. So the purpose of a sorceress is, I'm going to inhale or ingest these materials because I know it will change my perception of reality in such a way that I can reach out into the spirit world and contact the beings that live out there and get information or assistance from them. And God put this on the capital offense list, because it's trying to contact the enemy. It's trying to contact Satan and the other fallen angels, and that's not right. It is forbidden behavior for the people of Israel who are supposed to be completely sold out to God, completely loyal to Him. So it is, in effect, a form of traitorism, or being a traitor, treachery. And that's why it's a capital offense. Verse number 19. Another one that is really strong, and maybe this is one of those places where I should have already given my warning, and I shall do it now. Before we talk about this, if you've got younger listeners around, you need to distract them elsewhere. You need to turn the radio off. Or pause your podcast, because this is PG-13 material. Okay? Countdown, 3, 2, 1, here we go. Verse number 19 says, whoever lies with an animal shall be put to death. The technical term for this is bestiality. It is engaging in sexual behavior with any type of animal. doesn't matter. Sexuality was designed by God between one man and one woman for a lifetime. That was his design. Anything outside of it is inappropriate, and some things outside of that boundary are absolutely abominable, and this would be one of those things, to try to have sex with an animal, and therefore it is a capital offense. Verse number 20. Oh, by the way, if you're not aware, it is becoming more and more of a problem in our modern day permissive society. Verse 20. Whoever sacrifices to any god other than to he who is alone shall be devoted to destruction, which is another way of saying shall be executed. It is a matter of loyalty here. God, the true creator God, who is getting these Israelis out of Egypt and is taking them toward the promised land, is the only God that they should be serving. And for them to have a relationship with any other god is disloyal. It is cheating on him. And it is therefore a form of being a traitor. It is a form of treachery, and that carries with it capital punishment. The Israelis are going to have a problem with this over and over and over again, and it actually starts here at this time. The Israelis, as they're coming out of Egypt, are carrying in their baggage their little secret idols, and God will call them on it more than once. I can see by the clock that we're pretty much out of time, so let's mark our place here, and we'll get back into the Word tomorrow.